heard when the Paris Piano Trio and Isai Quartet join forces, and vibraphone whiz Stefan Harris and his group Blackout take the stage. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about tax reform. Just last week, the President's Advisory Panel on Federal Tax Reform set out some recommendations on changes to the federal tax code. And this was a panel that was set up by the President. It was announced when he was delivering his State of the Union address earlier this year. The panel's headed by two former senators, Connie Mack, a Republican, and John Breaux, a Democrat. They have made a number of recommendations on changing tax rates, on changing or modifying some very popular and widely used deductions. No one really expects that this will be passed as is. However, I think a lot of people expect that it will be the basis for a discussion that will continue now for some time. It's likely that the president would pull something from the panel's recommendations, and perhaps he will include that in his next State of the Union address. He has said that he wants tax reform to be, has said that it's going to be a priority for him, something he wants to work on. And it's also likely that in the near future, the Congress will be talking more and more about this. The reaction to the recommendations broke down fairly predictably along partisan lines, and I'll just want to give you a couple of quotes just to give you an idea. The minority leader in the House, Nancy Pelosi, she's a Democrat from California, she said, "Unfortunately, President Bush's tax panel is a Trojan horse, using so-called simplification to cut taxes for the wealthy while increasing taxes for middle-class families." Another comment here, this comes from Jim DeMint. He's a senator from South Carolina. He's a Republican, he said, and other Republicans have said, "Recommendations don't go far enough." He said, "We need comprehensive reform that will make America the best place in the world to invest and do business." And I'm sure the conversation will proceed from there. We thought that it would be a good idea here to talk a little bit about what has been proposed, and because it is likely to be the basis for the conversation from here on out. And so for that, we go to our guest for this hour of the show, Richard Kaplan. He's professor of law at the University of Illinois College of Law. He is an internationally recognized expert on U.S. taxation and tax policy. And just as an aside, he also developed one of the first law school courses on elder law and is also faculty advisor for the Elder Law Journal and has been since it came into being. And that's something we've talked about on the show. We've talked about Social Security, and we have talked about tax issues, and he's been good enough to come back again and spend a little time talking about the commission and some of the things the commission has recommended. So, as we talk, of course, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455 is our Champaign-Urbana number, and we also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. And then locally, 333-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David.
The commission made some recommendations and then made a couple of sets of recommendations, sort of two packages that have to do basically with tax rates. And then they went on and said, and there are a number of other things that we would suggest, and we can talk about those things. But basically, they want to eliminate the alternative minimum tax, which is the tax everyone seems to love to hate. We have the cap on the interest on your mortgage that you can deduct. That's something that's also been recommended. And they're also recommended getting rid of completely deductions for state and local taxes. And sort of there are some other things. Maybe we could start here. And I must confess that I'm a little bit confused about the two plans here. One they call the Simplified Income Tax Plan. The other they call the Growth and Investment Tax Plan. Basically, now, what is it that they're talking about here?
First of all, I think the main point to begin with is the one that you underscored at the outset, and that is this is a recommendation to the president. It is not self-actualizing. It doesn't really even get introduced unless the president and some congressional people want to put it forward. How this proceeds at this point is the report has been given to the Treasury Department, and they will cogitate on it, they will modify it, they will give a little political twists and tweaks, and then, as you indicated, it'll be presented and perhaps be the domestic highlight in the State of the Union message. So there are a whole bunch of issues about definitions, about transition rules, effective dates, that this report really doesn't even try to consider. It basically says this is how we think the best way to reform the income tax law ought to be. Having said that, there were no accountants on this panel. There was only one lawyer, and she was not a tax person. She was a specialist in the process of legislation. And so her contribution was to suggest what is politically doable. For that reason, they took a look at some alternatives that some people wanted, such as an outright retail sales tax, a straightforward consumption tax, and they thought that that those kind of proposals were simply not politically doable. They were non-starters in the lexicon of Washington. So what they did was modify the existing income tax and did so in two basic formulas, but with respect to individuals and households, the two are almost identical. So we may want to focus more of our attention on the elements that are in common, because where the point of divergence is really on how it affects, how these two plans affect big businesses. Even small businesses are treated pretty similarly under both plans. But with respect to households and individuals, the approach was to go to a fewer number of brackets, four brackets versus six, and the biggest major change was to get rid of the so-called alternative minimum tax, a tax that hits less than 2% of Americans right now, but was scheduled to hit more in the sense that it wasn't indexed for inflation. And so the way that particular mechanism worked, if you paid more under one calculation than the other, you owed the higher burden. There, one of the main charges to this commission was to get rid of the alternative minimum tax, and that they do. That is just removed completely. In order to do that, however, they had to find the money that that tax was raising. And to do that and still try to simplify things and bring rates a little bit lower, they had to attack a variety of sacred cows, including some of the big deductions that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And in that respect, the simplified income tax and the growth version, which is more of a combination of income tax and consumption tax, are virtually identical. So for most of the listeners, the provisions that would apply to them are going to be the same in either package.
Yeah. One of the things that one of the articles that I came across made some attempt to construct some hypothetical, you know, as we do when we talk about these things, some hypothetical individuals, families, and said, this is their situation, this is how much money they make, and under these plans, this is what their tax would be. And first of all, I guess I would sort of underscore the point that you made, that the president said, whatever we do, we want this to be revenue neutral. And it seems that the members of the commission said, in talking about their proposals, they seem to be saying, we don't think that this will change what people pay in taxes very much from what they're paying now. And indeed, according to this article that I looked at, this particular article, they talked to somebody who was a tax expert, and they came up with these theoretical people. And as you say, if you compare what these people would pay under the simplified income tax plan and under the growth and investment tax plan, there's not very much difference between those two. It wouldn't make much difference which of these plans went into effect. However, there is a significant difference if you compare what people pay according to what people are paying now and what people would pay according to their income level. And indeed, it seems that people on the lower end of the income scale end up paying more in taxes than they do now, and that people on the upper end end up paying less tax than they do now. Now, I'm not sure if that's correct or not, but of course, that is the kind of thing that, for example, Congresswoman Pelosi is saying, and I'm sure other Democrats will say, these changes primarily benefits more wealthy people because they'll be paying less tax, and the burden is, if it's going to be revenue neutral, money's got to come from someplace, the burden ends up getting shifted down. Is that, do you think that that is what would happen?
That's a fair point. The commission was sensitive to that, to the panel, and I'm not a spokesman for the panel by any means, but some of their recommendations were, you might say, limited by their charge. That is, President Bush did indicate that it must be revenue neutral, as you pointed out. They also took as a charge that the distribution of the tax burden had to stay roughly the same, because they realized that there had been a lot of criticism about growing economic inequality in this country, with incomes becoming more and more dispersed and wealth even more so. And the effort to repeal the estate tax, of course, would just exacerbate that. So they were trying to keep all of those issues off the table and to keep the tax burden, not only the total burden about where it is, but also the distribution of the tax burden approximately where it is. And the key word there is approximately. At the same time, President Bush gave them a number of objectives, and they sometimes contradict each other. For example, one of the things he really wanted was simplification. Not necessarily tax return simplification, the compliance end, but the idea of the interference of the tax code and how people manage their life and their finances. For example, right now, there are no fewer than 14 different kinds of plans that people can set up for their own retirement. The thought is that that was too many, that the variations were too fine for most people, leaving them in a state of paralysis where they actually do nothing. Similarly, there's something like 8 special provisions relating to education. The idea here was to cut through that debris, and the panel does that. Some people will come out better under the old scheme than under the new one, but for example, instead of 14 plans for retirement, now there are only 2. Instead of 8 different provisions for education, there is 1. So that kind of radical simplification was an objective. At the same time, President Bush also gave them an objective of making sure the code encouraged growth in the economy. Well, no one can really argue with that in the abstract, but what that means typically is that those who have the most amount of resources to invest in growing enterprises, which are the wealthier Americans, will have their tax burden, if not lowered, it's certainly kept the same, and that there should be certain activities within that, specifically capital investment, that would be encouraged and subsidized and incentivized through lower tax rates. So, for example, the capital gain tax on stock in U.S. companies is radically slashed under this proposal. Now, that theoretically could affect and benefit anybody who owns capital stock or stock in U.S. corporations. The fact of the matter is that some 3/4 to 4/5 of that benefit will go to people who earn over $200,000. That's just the pattern of realized capital gains that we've had literally going back for half a century. At the same time, the distribution of the tax burden was something that the commission paid a great deal of attention to, and within their models, they found that the distribution of tax burden by quintiles, that is lowest 20% versus top 10%, is roughly the same as under current law. Now, that's not, of course, what they took as the baseline is current law, which is not to say that that's where you necessarily wanted to go, because we've had some substantial cuts in capital gain taxes and dividends that primarily benefit wealthier Americans. But if you use that as your baseline comparison, then this keeps things relatively the same. The key point there, and this is what makes tax policy so frustrating, is that almost any set of contradictory statements can be proven to be accurate. And that is, while the distribution tables are remarkably the same, that is, the burden for the top 20% before and after is more or less within 1%, within any given quintile, there will be winners and there will be losers. And that's why it's very possible to come up with some hypothetical individual families and say that this particular hypothetical family, they will be paying more tax and some other one will not. It's somewhat telling that there's a sharp breakdown at the $75,000 of income line. And for people who have $75,000 of income or less, there are 3 winners for every 2 losers. That is, within that group, 75,000 and under, the overall tax burden stays the same, but within that group, 3 people will come up with less tax and 2 will come up with more. The same data for people making more than $75,000, the ratio of winners to losers is 2-1. That is, there's two winners for every loser. And so it will necessarily depend on any given level of income. Does this person own a home? Does this person own two homes? Are those homes mortgaged? Do they live in a state that has high state and local income taxes? Depending on how you play with the assumptions, and that's not a pejorative, it's just a matter of, shall we compare the same person who lives in New York versus California versus Champaign, that individual will come out with more tax or less tax. Congressperson Pelosi, as you indicated, is from California. That's a state with a very high state income tax and very high local property taxes, both because they have high rates and because the property is worth a lot more. One of the major changes that was made very deliberately was to eliminate all state and local taxes from being a deduction. That's clearly going to have a bigger impact on families in California or New York than on families in states like Florida or Texas with no state income tax. And that would be exacerbated if the people had most of their wealth in stocks and bonds and less so in personal real estate.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Richard Kaplan. He's professor of law at the University of Illinois in the law school. He's an expert on tax policy, and we're talking about some of the recommendations that have just recently been made by the president's advisory panel on federal tax reform. They've been working on this for 10 months now. He announced this in his State of the Union address just earlier this year. It's expected now that the Treasury Department will take them and will be thinking about them. The president might well embrace some of these things and propose that they be put into law next year in his State of the Union address. And then, of course, that it will be from there. It will be up to Congress to decide what it is that they would want to do. So it is likely that this is one of those subjects that in Washington they'll be talking about for some time now to come. It is difficult to predict what sort of changes, if any, might take place. But it is one of those issues that's on near the top of a lot of people's agendas in Washington. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Indiana to talk with on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. This is one of those programs where each time the guest makes a sentence, you come up with 2 to 3 or sometimes 5 questions you want to ask him. Of course, that can't be done. So I just sort of get around the edges. Number 1, this commission, who are they? Where are they politically? In terms of the guest responses to some of your questions, It's nice to have somebody who says this is the way it is here and this is the way it is there, and presumably we're not leaning one way or the other in the political spectrum, and it's nice to have that kind of information. I wished I could find that information on the Internet so that you put this here and this is what plops out later on. But I guess my political persuasion and bias was hit me when I was in grade school, and we had a teacher. He didn't last long in my small town, but I remember him saying one time to our class, to make money, you got to have it. And so in those kind of perceptions with the commission's views on things, where does the tally actually go? I think of my aunt, who is at the place now where she has to make decisions about what medicine she's going to pay for, even though she has, up and down the line, all the things the government can help somebody with for getting drugs. And I remember once on your station a few days ago, I think it was Senator Durbin was talking about there's 116 or 162 drug programs the elderly can choose from. My aunt has trouble even reading, let alone trying to decide the subtleties between those kinds of things. I just sort of want to throw that in the mix and hope you can give something in response to that kind of anecdotal information. Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. I don't know where you want to start there. I did it at the beginning mention at least that the two men who are heading the commission, they're both former U.S. senators. One's a Democrat, one's a Republican. And you did talk a little bit about the rest of the makeup of the commission. I would think that there at least would have been an attempt to make this to make this bipartisan. It's at least to appear bipartisan so that no one would come along afterwards and say, well, obviously the commission has some sort of political cast to it, and that's going to affect what sort of recommendations they recommend that they put out there.
We could have hoped for that. Yes, the chair people, the two senators, come from different political parties. But even within that, Senator Brough has, the Democrat senator from Louisiana, has frequently sided with Republicans throughout his political career. He actually chaired a commission that was trying to reform Medicare. That report never got out because there was so much resistance from the Clinton White House in particular and from most of the Democratic Party. So he, in some ways, has been off the reservation, off the Democratic Party reservation on a whole lot of issues. In fact, some people actually referred to him as a dino. That's D-I-N-O, Democrat in name only. That may be a little harsh, but he was the only one who even had those sorts of pretensions. The rest of the panel was made up of primarily economists, some academic economists, mainly economists who worked in places like Charles Schwab and company and others, that President Bush felt personally very comfortable with. Some of these were people who had been at his other summits. At least two of them are people he has asked to be chair of his Council of Economic Advisors. So this was not a bipartisan panel in any sense. It may not have been as ideologically pure as the Social Security Commission of 2001, where everyone was a true believer in private accounts. But this was a very distinctly conservative economic bent. Having said that, they also recognize that there are some limitations as to what they could propose in terms of distribution of the tax burden, but their focus was lowering the tax burden on people with capital. For example, there is no real relief provided for wage earners, and for 3 out of 4 Americans, presently, they pay more taxes to Social Security than they do to the income tax. Social Security was completely off the table here. So the income tax was the exclusive focus, and accordingly, any revisions that modify that burden, that reduce it, are going to redound primarily to people who receive more of their income from capital than from wages. That sort of was a built-in bias by saying, by President Bush saying, I want you to focus on the income tax statute. Don't touch Social Security. Don't consider any of these other things. The caller, in fact, went on to talk about the Medicare prescription drug issue. And in fact, I have an article coming out on that next week, and that'd be perhaps appropriate for a separate program. But there is a difference in philosophy between the political parties. And one party thought that what seniors wanted was lots of choices rather than a one-size-fits-all plan. And the other indicated that they thought that what seniors really wanted was one plan, but you had a choice of providers and you didn't have to make all of these tricky comparisons. Well, the dominant party's philosophy was that American seniors wanted more choices rather than choice of providers. And so that's where we ended up with this Medicare Part D, which is a monstrosity, as Senator Durbin has indicated. But this particular commission was pretty much ideological conservatives who were focusing on what they have always suggested would be good for the growth of the economy, and pretty much were not paying attention to people who are primarily wage earners or people who are in the great bulk of Americans without serious capital. The premise was to reduce the burden on capital so as to grow the economy. That is one of the key principles that President Bush believes in, and that's how the panel was constituted.
Just to also to return for a moment to this discussion of winners and losers. It has been in what I have read, it has been remarked upon, particularly if you look at the changes that you mentioned, the changes that that would cap the mortgage interest that you could deduct, and the elimination of state and local taxes. They would say, as you have, if you ask the question who wins and who loses, you have to say, well, where do you live? If you live in a place where property values are very high, like California, and a place where the state and local taxes are very high, like California or New York, then you're going to lose because you're losing your ability to deduct those things. If you live in some place like Florida, for example, where the property values are not as high and the state and local taxes are not as high, then you might lose some, but you don't lose as much. And it has been pointed out that if you take those states as representative, that California did vote Democrat and Florida did vote Republican. So if you wanted to, you could say, aha, I am seeing some alignment here in terms of which way you lean politically and whether you gain or lose by this plan.
Now, there's no doubt that there's a certain blue and red cast to some of the tax proposals. For what it's worth, I think most of the members of the commission are actually living in high-tax states. There are at least two from California and one from Massachusetts. So they were arguing against their own personal interest if that was the case. There were philosophical arguments that I tend to take at face value, that it wasn't just a matter of let's punish the states that voted for Kerry, let's reward the states that voted for Bush. There will be a little bit of that impact, but I don't think that was the animating philosophy. For example, on state and local taxes, there was a thought that people in Oklahoma and Texas, Illinois to some degree, are having to pay more federal income tax because we are, according to this theory, subsidizing the people who have chosen to live in high tax states and are getting the better or at least the more expensive level of services. And that kind of cross state line, interstate cross subsidization was thought to be inappropriate. That's always been the case, but this was a group that actually felt that there should be some change made for that. The business about home mortgages is an incredibly hotly contested issue. For example, at the outset, how much of a tax incentive do you really need to encourage people to own their own home? That's kind of sort of a core element to the American dream. Most people, if they can afford it, would be willing to do so, whether there's a tax incentive or not. Even within that, the caps on the home mortgage interest deduction are modified or at least variable according to local cost of living. Mm-hmm. So the cap that would apply, and it's done on a county-by-county basis, which is going to make compliance a little difficult, but the point is the cap that applies to Champaign County would be significantly lower than the cap that would apply to, say, San Bernardino County or Orange County in California. Having said that, however, both of those are going to be substantially lower than the current cap, which is $1.1 million. In addition, people who wanted to tap into their home equity to finance college costs or buy a car, that possibility is being eliminated in its entirety. Same with the possibility of using deductible interest to buy a second home. They're focusing it exclusively on the principal residence. And that has the implication that even if you live in a very expensive area, but your mortgage is paid off, you don't care that much about the loss of the interest deduction. But for people who are paying that mortgage interest, if they're at about the median price of a home and under that, then they're going to have no problem under this cap. The people who are going to be hurting are the people who have purchased a home that is substantially above the local median, or who have purchased a second home, or who are trying to use home equity debt to finance other purchases. Those folks are all going to find much less tax benefits from the home mortgage interest deduction. And I think that was a deliberate policy decision. Another interesting aspect of some of the Treasury Department's data that came out actually before the commission report was issued, and this came out about 3 months ago, and they did a little analysis of what would the tax rates be to keep the tax burden the same and raise the same revenue if you got rid of the whole silly code, threw out all of the deductions, all of the credits, all of the exclusions, just took a big broom and swept it all out, but you kept the 10 most prominent tax leakages. And those include some of the ones that we're familiar with: the exclusion of premiums on health insurance, the exclusion of contributions to pension plans, the home mortgage interest, charitable contributions, capital gains, a few others. And if you just kept those 10 items, just kept those 10 most popular, most widely used items, and threw out the whole rest of the kit and caboodle, then what tax rates would you have? And the amazing thing was that you would have lower tax rates, but only by 1% or less, so that the top tax rate of 35 would become 34, and the middle tax rate of 25 would become 24.3%. Well, those are lower, but it's not exactly sufficiently lower to really get the reform juices going. And so what that meant was if they're going to have any kind of impact, if they're going to produce a rate structure that had perceptibly lower rates, they were going to have to tackle a number of items on that top 10 list, even though they are by definition the most significant, the most widely used, and the most politically sensitive. The home mortgage interest deduction is one of those, charitable contributions is another, and the one we haven't even talked about was this idea of capping how much you could exclude from health insurance. Right now, people don't even know how much their health insurance is cost if their employer provides it because the premium doesn't show up on a W-2 and they think it's free. They have no idea that the average is right around $5,000 a year for individual coverage and close to $12,000 for family coverage. Well, the commission says we're going to put a cap at the national average. If the employer wants to provide even more generous coverage, that's, of course, the employer's prerogative, but taxpayers will have to pick up that extra premium as additional phantom income. Mm. Again, that was the kind of thing that some people will come out behind, particularly union contracts and others that have more comprehensive health insurance. But if you weren't going to tackle those big items, then you weren't going to have enough revenue to play with to make any difference to repeal the alternative minimum tax or do anything else, really.
We have another caller we'll get to, and that's someone listening this morning in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. I wonder if your guest could comment on this comment. As far as the tax structure goes, most economists, almost nearly all economists, agree that if the economy needs a stimulus, and there are indeed times when that is the case, that tax relief to those that are the consumers in our country would be for the greatest effect, and that is the lower and middle class. And so I guess just my comment really is that I feel like the administration sells the same old trickle-down economics that are a failed economic policy.
Okay. Well, you want to comment on that?
Sure. I'm not a professional economist at all, but I've read enough of what they've issued over the years to feel fairly comfortable with what they do. And you're quite right that if you're trying to stimulate the economy in a demand sense, then you need to get tax cut relief to the people who will take the money out and spend it. Indeed, one only needs to look at the last couple weeks of reports from various investment banks and stock market commentators that say the thing they're worried about the most is that the consumer is tapped out, that the Christmas shopping season will not be as robust, that people have basically tapped out their borrowing and are not going to be able to buy more stuff, which stimulates the providers to create some. Well, if that is the concern, if that is where people are focusing, then this entire tax reform panel is basically out to lunch because they didn't address that sort of economic impact at all. Instead, they were taking much more of what's traditionally called a supply-side approach, or as the caller suggested more colorfully, trickle-down economics of the idea that if you provide tax relief to the suppliers of capital, then that will produce businesses that will produce goods and so forth. If you believe in that, and this is largely a theological debate, but if you believe in that, then what you want to see is lower taxes on capital gains, on dividends, and other sorts of returns from capital, including interest. That it was the operating philosophy, I think theology is almost a better word, for this particular tax reform panel. If the charge had been, we want to stimulate the economy, give relief for lower and middle Americans, try to get the relief into hands of people who will take the money out and immediately spend it, then, for example, you wouldn't have taken the Social Security tax off the table. Since 3 out of 4 Americans pay more in that, you ought to talk about lowering the Social Security tax or having remove the cap on the salary rate so that the rates could be adjusted downward. Not suggesting that we would want to do that, but the point is that if you're looking at more of a demand-side approach to tax relief for consumers, then you would have to consider Social Security tax to be a key component of the burden that most Americans face. As
I
say,
can I make a real quick comment on that?
Sure.
As far as the tax relief to the lower and the middle class, that is a guaranteed success. okay, it is going to go into the hands of the people that will be spending the money. The supply side of trickle-down economics can work, but it's inherently, there's some inherent risk to it in that if a recession is, you know, we're at the cusp of a recession, then the rich know how to save. They have money. They're not the major drivers of the economy. So the supply side has some inherent risk to it. There is no risk to stimulating economic growth to giving it to the lower and the middle class.
It's a fair point. In fact, in 1986, this same debate was related to the interest deduction. We've been talking this morning about caps on the mortgage interest deduction, but those of us who've been around will remember that prior to the 1986 Act, all interest was deductible. Interest on credit cards, interest on revolving accounts at department stores, interest on automobiles, and all of that was to provide at least some tax relief, if not some stimulus, to people who would be going out and spending, buying refrigerators, stereos, DVD players, not just homes. The decision was made in 1986 with a lot of dissents at the time that the only interest that would be continued to be deductible would be related to homes. And that, in effect, was a bit of an anti-consumer, anti-demand side decision. The current panel didn't even try to reconsider that and say restore an interest deduction for purchases of goods and credit cards and so forth. It's an interesting question whether that 1986 change has had some effect on the increasing numbers of Americans who are filing consumer bankruptcy, for example. But the point is the current panel took as their starting point the 1986 decision that said that the only interest that will be preference, the only interest that will be deductible is on homes. And that for automobiles, education for that matter, revolving accounts, credit cards, furniture purchases, none of that interest would be deductible. And what they did is then cut back the current panel on how much the home mortgage interest would be deductible. But they did not even think within their scope to think about providing economic stimulus to people who would be current consumers. You're right.
Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. We have about 10, 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Richard Kaplan. He's professor of law in the U of I Law School, and he is a specialist in taxation and tax policy. We're talking about some of the recommendations that were made just recently by the President's Advisory Panel on Federal Tax Reform that might, or then again, might not end up being put into law. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I thought I'd try to get some info on just a general overview of what's it. I mean, we keep hearing about all these unfunded liabilities coming up in terms of all these baby boomers, for example, retiring and the cost of their medical care and nursing homes and all of that, and I was wondering, has anyone tried to put together a sketch of what the tax structure would have to be to cover those unfunded liabilities at all, or does everybody look at it and say it's an impossible feat?
It's an interesting question. This particular panel had no authority to go beyond even the income tax. In fact, it's even more restricted than that sounds. As I already indicated, and as David pointed out, the charge was for them to come up with a plan that is revenue neutral, that is, that would raise the same amount of revenue, not a penny more, than the current system. But actually, their revenue estimates only go out 10 years, and that was by their design. In fact, one of the commission members was responding to a complaint that pointed out that a lot of these retirement plans that are in the tax reform panel may be revenue neutral over 10 years, but then it's going to be a gigantic revenue loser. So the caller's concern about the baby boom putting additional strains on government resources for Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and nursing home and all that. That's true, but it's not going to be there for about 10 years. And one of the sort of aspects of unreality of this particular tax reform panel was says that they were going to find a plan that was revenue neutral over 10 years and pay no attention to what happens after that. The people who have looked at this, for the most part, say, well, it may be revenue within the 10-year window, but after that, it's a gigantic revenue loser, bleeding revenues precisely at the time, as this caller points out, when the government is going to need more resources. Now, in response to that, one of the commission members had this quote, which I love, and he says, quote, as you look down the road and estimate revenues and expenses, you've either got to be goofy or stupid to think you're going to be anywhere near right. Unquote. Well, that explains why they didn't try to go out more than 10 years, at least if you want to take it at face value. But the point is, they made no effort to increase revenues even in the 10-year window, and they were completely oblivious to what happens after 10 years. You're quite right that the government is going to face some significant outlays starting just about the time that 10-year window expires, but that was not the charge of this commission. And President Bush made it very clear that he did not want to use tax simplification or tax reform as a guise, as he put it, to increase the tax burden on American taxpayers. If the government is going to need more resources in 10 years, then this panel was given no authority to try to begin raising revenue for that. If there was any thought given to that problem at all, it was in the form that if the economy is stimulated and is growing, then maybe those problems will be ameliorated in the future. But that was the extent of their focus on what's going to happen in 10 years with respect to significant baby boomer related outlays.
Well, that's very interesting, but it sounds as if they deliberately want to give the impression that they're dealing with long-term when they're really not. And but I'm just curious. The academics are the ones that would most likely, I would think, sit there and try to puzzle all this out. And have they made any effort to? One of the major tenets of personal finance and small business finance is if you see this big expenditure coming up in the future, you try to, put away some money to cover it. And I think an academic might be able to try to quantify this huge problem coming up and might try to think in terms of what a tax rate or structure would look like that might try to cover it. And has anybody at all? Or
there have been some efforts to kind of quantify how much, for example, the Social Security payroll tax would have to be raised or income taxes would have to be raised. But because the numbers are sufficiently scary, they usually walk away from it. But, for example, on the issue of should people take their IRA and convert it into a Roth IRA so that you pay tax today at today's rates, but you wouldn't have to worry about it in the future. And a lot of the personal finance advice has been, well, that may not be a good deal because they're going to have to raise tax rates in the future, and they may change the tax treatment of the Roth IRA, even though they've promised at the time that would be tax-free. So there is a real issue there. But you're quite right. The government operates under different rules than individual households. Not the least of which because the government has this machine in the basement, which most of us do not have, called a printing press. And if push comes to shove, they can just step on the accelerator and print their way out of it. That may not be a very appealing prospect, but they do have that possibility. For most people who face a looming major expense, they would try to start putting some away. Well, that would suggest that we ought to be running surpluses right now before the baby boom hits. We're not doing that. We're running deficits. We were running deficits before the Iraq War came about. We were running deficits before the Katrina relief effort was initiated. In light of those two items, though, we're not raising taxes. We're not cutting back other areas. And just yesterday, the House of Representatives shied away from making cuts in other domestic programs. Perhaps because they wanted to see some contribution on the tax side, but this president has been consistent and very clear on that there would not be any raising of tax revenues during his administration. There is an expression that's almost as colloquial as the one you mentioned, which is that if you're in a hole, you should stop digging. That's the same kind of thing here. With the anticipation of the retirement of the boomers, et cetera, I think one of the Congress people actually made a frustrated remark on the in the debate, said, when are we going to stop digging? Well, that's a good question, because there's proposals, quite apart from this tax reform panel, to actually extend the tax cut on capital gains and dividends to keep it as low as it is now. Right now, those cuts are supposed to expire, and they thought it's a priority item to ensure that those rates stay low. The estate tax is another kind of thing. If you're going to be reducing government revenue, then it's more likely that you're going to have deficits result. And the tax policy has been, some would say, obsessed, others hijacked by this notion that we're not going to be raising revenues in the foreseeable future under any plan that this president will countenance.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Just to, again, obviously, there's a lot here. It is very complicated. We've talked about a lot of things. But just as a way of asking a question about how difficult it would be politically to make some of these changes. And I guess I want to stay with the mortgage deduction. That we know that this is a very popular deduction. A lot of people take it. Under the changes that the panel proposes, there would be still some people who would get to deduct all of their mortgage interest. If you lived in a place where property values were relatively, sort of my understanding, it goes something like this. You live in a place where property values are relatively low. If your house was worth less than, say, $200,000, you could still deduct all of your mortgage interest. If you lived in a place where the property values were higher and your house was worth less than, say, $400,000, you could still deduct your interest. And then everybody would get some, above that, everybody would get to deduct something, but not all the interest they paid. So some people not affected at all. Some people still get to deduct something, but not as much as they do now. And I expect that the body of people who are affected, it's still going to be significant. It's going to be a lot of people that are going to see their ability to deduct their mortgage interest would be cut from what it is now, making this politically a very difficult thing. And in fact, this is one of those things that in the past it was considered to be something that you just didn't do. You just didn't touch. You could do a lot of other things, but don't go near this deduction because it's just too popular. How doable, actually, do you think that it is?
That's a super question, David. Tax reform inevitably produces winners and losers. The people who lose will have that calculation pretty well underhand, as you just did, and they will write letters and they will contact the Congress people and say, what am I getting out of this? And that's quite right. Now, in 1986, the last time this was really attempted, and one of the reasons this is not done every year in terms of tax reform is because if you're going to stay within the constraint of revenue neutrality, that means that for every person whose taxes you cut, there's going to be someone whose taxes you're going to raise, either indirectly through limiting mortgage interest deduction or more directly by raising the rates, and those people will complain. So the reason this is done infrequently is because this is somewhat radioactive as an issue. In 1986, when it was done, not only was there a general better feeling of bipartisanship, but also how they did revenue neutrality then was make 94% of individuals come out ahead, and the revenue neutrality was accomplished by raising taxes on the corporate sector. Well, this time that's not going to be allowed. And so that means there are going to be more people complaining. And the calculation that you mentioned, that's just the beginning of it. For example, the banks who lend the money for mortgages, they are going to have a tougher time if the consumers, the borrowers, are not going to be able to borrow at all. Real estate agents are going to be upset that people are more hesitant to take on debt because they're not going to be able to get a tax benefit for the entire amount. Home builders are going to be concerned that if they're building homes that are above the median, they're going to have a harder time selling it because people will not be able to get the tax subsidy or the tax benefits that they would have in the past. Unlike oil and gas, which is a big issue in actually only about three states, real estate is a big issue in all 50 states. Mm-hmm. And in every single congressional district, there are homeowners. So now you're not just sort of isolating or targeting the people who are coming out behind, but it's going. There's a reason why in 1986 they said, well, we'll terminate deduction of interest on credit cards, but hey, Home ownership, we don't want to touch that. That's the third rail of politics. That's the American dream. So, but as I indicated, if you don't touch this, then you don't have enough revenue to play with, in part because a lot of the deductions were wiped out in 1986, and now they have to go after this. It is politically sensitive. Some call it courageous. There's other things. For example, the capital gain preference that I mentioned about applying to stock in U.S. companies. It excludes any capital gain on any investor in real estate, not just homes, but raw land and shopping centers and everything else. For those people, they will be seeing a significant increase in their tax burden. Again, this is an industry that lives in every single congressional district. People who have whole life insurance policies that actually accrue cash surrender value. Right now, that inside buildup, as it's called, is not taxed. The panel proposes to tax it every year as it accrues. You're going to have the entire insurance industry up in arms, again, across the country. That is one of the things I think the Treasury Department is kind of going through the panel's report and saying, which of these political cows do we want to kick and which ones should we try to put some relief for, or at least not hit as hard. But if they don't follow the panel's commission report, then what they're going to have is that the tax rates are not going to go down even as little as the panel commission report does. And then you get to a kind of congressional stalemate that says, here, we're making all these enemies. And what are we getting for it?
Yeah. We're really at the point where we're going to have to stop. And I can't exactly give you enough time to answer the question. But given the fact that making the changes that we've talked about are difficult, as you say, the last time there was a major overhaul of the tax code, it was 1986. So it's been a long time. What of any of this do you think is likely to at least be prepared? Be put up for a vote in Congress?
Well, I think President Bush is going to highlight tax reform in the State of the Union message. At that point, it's really up in the air depending on how the war is going, what other catastrophes happen, and just whether people who are running in Congress, who are in an election year, whether they want to tackle all of these sensitive issues in a year when they have to face the voters, even though President Bush does not.
Well, we will see what happens. I'm sure we'll have the opportunity to talk again. I thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Our guest, Richard Kaplan, he's professor of law at the U of I College of Law. He's an expert on taxation, U.S. taxation, and tax policy. Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast is also made possible with support from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, with an international brunch, lunch, and new seasonal dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria now features Sunday dinner with a different and unique menu every week. Coming up a little bit later today as part of the Afternoon Magazine, in the Catholic Church in the United States today, women represent more than 80% of lay paid parish ministers and 70% of chaplains serving in hospitals, in hospices, in colleges, and prisons. On the Afternoon Magazine today, you will hear the rebroadcast of an interview with journalist Angela Bonavoglia. She is author of the book Good Catholic Girls, How Women Are Leading the Fight to Change the Church. That's in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. The show gets underway at noon with news, sports, weather, other things. Celeste Quinn is the host. In the next part of this program, we'll be talking about what research on twins can tell us about human development. Our guest will be Nancy Siegel. She's director of the Twin Study Center at Cal State University in Fullerton. That'll be in the next part of the show. First, though, we'll break for news and update on the markets. Stay tuned.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps